Today I'd like to talk about the scientific implications of the creation-evolution controversy. There are two charges that are leveled against us by the evolutionists. Number one, that the origin of the idea of creation comes from the Bible, and the Bible is a religious book, and therefore we are trying to teach religion in the public schools, which is contrary to the First Amendment of the Constitution. Number two, it is charged that creationism is not science. Science deals with natural explanations that are falsifiable, and creationism is neither a natural explanation nor is it falsifiable. So today I'd like to address these two charges and give you really the essence of what I testified about at the trial in Arkansas as a religious expert. Number one, how can creationism be science if it has a religious origin? Seems pretty obvious that the people who are defending creationism generally come from a Judeo-Christian background, and the basic document from that background is the Bible. Seems pretty obvious that the idea for creation comes from Genesis. And I think that is not a fact that we should even try to conceal, let alone is it concealable historically. Now, if that's true, do not the opponents of creationism have a prima facie case that this is a religious teaching, because it obviously is derived from a religious source? In response to that, I would like to make a couple points. First of all, to point out that many scientific and philosophical theories also have a religious source. And the essence of my point here is simply this. You do not judge a scientific theory by its source, but by its scientific justifiability. For example, Socrates was inspired in his philosophy from a religious source, the Oracle of Delphi. Now, if a pagan prophetess can be the source of Western philosophy, as it emanated from Socrates, then we have to ask the question, would anyone ever reject Western philosophy because it had a religious source, the prophetess of Delphi? And the answer is obviously no one has ever rejected either Socrates or his philosophy or Western philosophy because it had a religious source that encouraged Socrates. Secondly, modern rationalistic philosophy, as it emanated from René Descartes, on November 15th, back in the early 1600s, René Descartes received three dreams, the one involving a watermelon and the one involving a book. And on the basis of these dreams, he was inspired to write and propagate his rationalistic philosophy. Now, so far as I know, no one has ever rejected the philosophy of Descartes or modern philosophy or rationalism because it had a religious-like source, three successive dreams. Furthermore, one of the greatest ironies in modern thought is Herbert of Kerbury, who was the father of modern deism, which is the belief that everything can be explained naturalistically, was encouraged to write and publish his philosophy by a supernatural voice from the sky. Now, so far as I know, no one has ever rejected naturalism because the source was a supernatural voice from the sky. And yet that was the source of modern deism from which comes naturalism. Or to go over into the scientific world, it is commonly known in the scientific world that there were some weird religious sources for some of the major scientific theories. One of my favorites is Kekulé, who invented the model for the benzene molecule. This model for the benzene molecule was given to Kekulé in a vision of a snake biting its tail. Now, this is common knowledge in the scientific world that Kekule received the source of his scientific theory in a vision of a snake biting its tail. And yet no one has ever said, "See if I accept the benzene molecule anymore." Those weirdos getting it from snakes biting their tails. And the reason for that is very simply this. Scientists do not care about the source of a model. They only want to know whether it is scientifically adequate or justifiable. Another illustration that's favorite to me is Tesla, the man who invented the alternating current motor that we're using right now in this room to make the life we enjoy possible and that you use dozens of times every day. Do you know where Tesla got the idea, the source of the alternating current motor? He got it in a vision while he was reading the pantheistic poet Goethe. Now, I don't know anybody who refuses to turn on a switch because Tesla was a pantheistic religious devotee who read Goethe. Why? Because they don't care about the source of a model. They only care about the scientific justifiability of the model. Herbert Spencer, who developed the cosmic theory of evolution, received his inspiration for the evolutionary theory on Sunday morning at the beach meditating on the waves. And no one has ever rejected the cosmic theory of evolution because he got it on Sunday morning meditating on the waves. Some time ago, someone gave me a copy of this article, How Old is the Earth?, published in SQL magazine out of Purdue University Science Department. Here's what he says. In closing, I would like to stress that I have no quarrel with the creationist use of Genesis and other parts of the Bible as sources of ideas, scientific or otherwise. The ultimate test of a scientific theory or model is the degree to which it efficiently and logically correlates our perceptions of our surroundings, both spatial and temporal. Depending on the idiosyncrasies of the individual scientist, any source of ideas, inspiration, or insight may be useful for model building. Experimental observation, the Quran, the Bible, a revelation, numerology, a dream, or hallucinations. Now, unfortunately, he didn't testify at the trial in Arkansas because the judge in Arkansas ruled that creationism cannot be taught in the public schools because the idea comes from the book of Genesis. And that's contrary to the very premise held in the scientific community for the ideas of scientific theories. It doesn't matter where it came from. A hallucination, a dream, a vision of a snake biting its tail, or the book of Genesis. The question is, which model theory adequately accounts for the facts? Second thing I would like to say in answer to this question, how can creationism be science if it has a religious origin, is to point out that many things that were first mentioned in the Bible were later proven to be scientifically true. Let's take a couple examples. Hezekiah's tunnel was mentioned in the Bible. Hezekiah, who built the tunnel to defend the city of Jerusalem against attacks that were later given by Sennacherib and others, Hezekiah built this tunnel. And the Bible says that he built it. Now, archaeologists went digging around and they found the tunnel. Should archaeologists not publish or not teach in the public schools about Hezekiah's tunnel because the origin of the idea came from the Bible? As a matter of fact, the Hittites were a nation mentioned only in the Bible until not too many years ago when the whole Hittite library was found in Turkey. Now, before that time, critics would say, another myth in the Bible, another one of those ideas in the Bible that cannot be substantiated from history because there's no record of the Hittites. Now that we know, and all scholars know, that the Hittites were civilization, we have their library. Should we reject teaching that information in the public schools because the origin of the idea came from the Bible? If so, that means one whole science, Near Eastern archaeology, whose main and original inspiration came from studying the Bible, should be rejected because science happened to confirm something that came from the Bible. I think that same logic should be applied to the question of creation. It isn't a question whether Genesis 1 teaches creation. It does. It isn't a question where we got our idea. We're not hiding it from anybody. We got it from Genesis. It's a question of whether that idea or model is scientifically adequate to meet the facts and to account for all of the data. The second point I'd like to make was brought up at the trial and in the evolutionists who critique creationism is simply this. How can an object of religious devotion, God, Creator, be approached in a strictly scientific way? Or another way to put the problem is, yes, but in all of the illustrations you gave, Tesla's alternating current, the snake, and so forth, none of them were objects of religious devotion. But in the question of creation, that implies a creator, and the creator is an object of religious devotion, and therefore you're teaching religion when you mention a creator, but you're not teaching religion when you mention a snake or a vision of an alternating current. Now let me approach this one, both historically and logically. First of all, Aristotle, who in many respects was one of the first great systematic thinkers in the Western world, developed a cosmology in which he had, at the beginning of the chain of causes, an unmoved mover, God. Aristotle said there must be a creator, someone to give the first initial causal power and energy to the universe. Otherwise, it wouldn't be moving, but it is moving. Now, an interesting thing about Aristotle's unmoved mover is that Aristotle never worshipped the unmoved mover, because the unmoved mover was not an object of religious worship. It was a cosmological explanation for the origin of the universe. So the prime example of one of the greatest minds who ever lived is exactly the point we're making. You can refer to a creator without making the creator the object of your religious devotion. Aristotle did. All of the Aristotelians did. We have a classic case of a Greek outside of the Christian tradition. And when we say creationism in the public school, we are not asking the students to worship the creator. We're asking the students to acknowledge that one of the possibilities of explaining the data is that there must have been a creator, a first cause. Someone pointed out, we haven't defined the first cause. We haven't given religious attributes to the first cause by virtue of the scientific evidence. We are not calling upon people to make a commitment to the first cause. We are simply saying, if it happens to be the best explanation, or at least one possible explanation, why should we neglect it simply because someone has made it an object of religious worship? The same is true of Plato, the other great philosopher from the ancient world. Plato had a demiurgos. The demiurgos was the one, the former, who looked at the form and who formed the world. But the demiurgos was not the ultimate object in Plato's universe. The good was the ultimate object. One made a commitment to the good because that was the ultimate. Even the demiurgos got his ideas from the good. So Plato's God was not the object of ultimate commitment. Aristotle's God, they were cosmological explanations. We're not defining the creator in creationism in a science lab. We're simply saying you must posit one to explain creation. Thirdly, if you reject an object of religious worship in a public school, then you must also reject bringing up Buddha or Christ in a history class. Because there is historical evidence to support the fact that Christ lived, and he is the object of religious worship of many people called Christians. There is historic evidence to support that Buddha lived, and he's the object of religious devotion by many people called Buddhists. Therefore, we must eliminate any religious figure who has been the object of religious devotion and cannot present the scientific or historical evidence because somebody might worship them. See, by reductio ad absurdum, it's ridiculous to say we must eliminate God from a science classroom because somebody might worship God if we bring him up. Well, then we must eliminate rocks from a geology classroom because people have worshipped rocks too. So let's get rid of all the rocks and not analyze rocks because people have worshipped them. See, rocks have been objects of religious devotion. Buddha and Christ have been object of religious devotion. God has been. But in a science classroom, we are not teaching God as an object of religious devotion. We are teaching Creator as an explanation of a scientific process. That leads to a very important distinction that I would like to make, and that indeed I did make in my testimony at the trial. It's brought up by Paul Tillich, the Harvard theologian, who said there are two ways to approach the same ultimate. If you approach the ultimate from a detached standpoint, an objective detached standpoint, we could call that philosophy. If you approach the ultimate from a committed standpoint, we call that religion. Now, one and the same object can be approached from two different standpoints. One of his students, Dr. Langland Gilkey from University of Chicago, who also testified at the trial, in his book, Maker of Heaven and Earth, uses the illustration of a mountain. He said it's like people climbing up a mountain from two different sides, the philosophical side, the objective approach, and the religious side, the subjective approach. He said it's the same mountain, the same peak, but two different approaches. They're both legitimate. Now I commend to you that teaching creation, which implies a creator, from a scientific, objective point of view, is not teaching religion, because the crucial element in religion is commitment, involvement. Let me try and illustrate the difference. Let's think of an elevator. And you look at the elevator and you look inside and there's no floor there. And you look down the elevator shaft and you say, I'm not going to make a commitment. Why? Because there is no evidence that the elevator is going to take you up. There's evidence that you're going to go down farther and fast. Now, what I'm trying to illustrate is the difference between belief that and belief in. Belief that is an objective thing. What sort of objective evidence do I have that it's an elevator, that it will hold me, that there's a floor in there? That's strictly scientific, empirical, objective. Belief in is a commitment. That's whether you want to hop in the elevator. Maybe you don't like elevators. Maybe you like stairways or escalators. That's belief in and commitment. When you're teaching science, you don't call for belief in. You only present evidence that. And anybody who has read Paul Tillich or Langdon Gilkey or who has approached the subject from analyzing what religion and what science is know that there are two different approaches to the same thing. Let me give another illustration. Suppose an obstetrician who is approaching his particular art and science in a purely objective way for the health of his patients suddenly finds himself getting romantically involved with a patient. You say, well, he's no longer approaching the object of his scientific research in a detached, objective way. It's now a subjective, involved commitment. And the same difference exists in approaching the Creator objectively, scientifically, and approaching the Creator from a religious perspective. I firmly believe that it is unconstitutional to teach a particular religious point of view and to call for a religious commitment in the public schools. But scientific creationism isn't doing that. Scientific creationism is saying if Aristotle and Plato can have a non-religious object, if Buddha and Christ can be worshipped by some but still approached historically, if you can approach something objectively from the standpoint of belief that, without necessarily calling on a commitment to, then it can be done, and I think it ought to be done in our schools. Suppose, for example, that creationism were true. If creationism were true, then what we're saying, in effect, by eliminating it from the public schools, is that it might be true, but it can't be taught. It might be the best explanation for the scientific material, and we are scientists, and we are open to the truth, but even though it could be true and could be the explanation, we won't allow it to be taught. That would put public education in the position of saying, we're not interested in truth, no matter what it happens to be. I think the conclusion is obviously absurd. Now let me move to the third point and ask the question, is creationism really science? Is it falsifiable? Is it testable? As the theory of evolution is testable. The first thing I'd like to point out on this is a historic comment, then a common sense comment, and then a logical conclusion. Historically, almost all of the original scientists were creationists. Let me give you a couple quotes to this effect. Bacteriology, the science of bacteriology, was originated by Louis Pasteur. He was a creationist. Calculus, originated by Sir Isaac Newton. He was a creationist. Celestial mechanics, Johann Kepler was the founder. He was a creationist. Chemistry, Robert Boyle. He was a creationist. Genetics, Gregory Mendel. He was a creationist. Glacial geology, again, Louis Agassiz from Harvard, a creationist. Hydraulics, Leonardo da Vinci, he was a creationist. Hydrostatics, Pascal, he was a creationist. Physical astronomy, Kepler. Thermodynamics, James Clerk Maxwell, he was a creationist. This is just some of the list of the original scientists. Now, I find it incredible that if the original scientists were creationists, how scientists today can look at creationism and say, it's not science. That's like the child denying that the parent existed. Furthermore, not only were the original scientists largely creationists, but almost everybody was a creationist from 1620 to 1860, for the first 240 years of the history of science. From the time that Lord Bacon in 1620 wrote the Novum Organum and started modern science, the father of modern science has been called, until 1859, when Darwin published The Origin of the Species, almost everybody was a creationist. Now, for a few Johnny-come-lately naturalists to look back at the foundations of modern science in 240 years of its history and say, they weren't scientists when they started science, when they dominated the fields of science, seems to me to be a little narrow in its perspective and a little forgetful of history. The second point I would like to make is simply a commonsensical point. Let's take Charles Darwin as an example. Before he devised his theory of natural selection, Charles Darwin was a creationist. Charles Darwin was a creationist after he devised his theory of natural selection as well. Because before he devised it, he believed that God specially created all of the various species. He was trained under the works of Paley. He believed them, and he was committed to them in some sense until he discovered natural selection and gave a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the species, but he still said in the last line of Origin of the Species, God created the first form of life. So he's even a creationist after, except he only has God creating one thing. Now let me ask you this. Is it reasonable, commonsensical, to say that Charles Darwin ceased being a scientist because he changed his scientific view from creationism to evolution? Or is it reasonable to say that Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species, because it refers to the creation of one form of life, should not be taught in the public schools? Now, I find it just somehow commonsensically incredible to believe that what the Arkansas judge ruled, namely that you may not refer to creation or imply a creator in a public school, is possibly a sound scientific approach because it would rule out Charles Darwin before and after he became an evolutionist. And it would say that unless you take the last paragraph out of Darwin's book, that it can't be taught in the public school either. We've come to illogical and nonsensical conclusions in our overreaction against creationism. Now let me approach it logically. Logically, there are only two views. Either there is a supernatural explanation for the origin of life, or there's a natural explanation for the origin of life. Now there are really three crucial points of tension. The origin of the universe, the origin of first life, and the origin of new life forms. Let's take those three points of tension. There are only two views on each of those three points. The origin of the universe either happened by natural laws or was created by some supernatural being. The origin of first life either happened by spontaneous generation or was created by some intelligent being. The origin of new life forms either happened by a natural process like natural selection or they were directly created by God. There aren't three views. Even the evolutionists admit that there are only two explanations. Now, if there are only two explanations, there are only two teams playing on the court, is it fair for one basketball team, the one that wins, to look at the other basketball team and say, you know, they're not really playing basketball. They aren't even a basketball team. Now, just logically, somehow, I find that difficult to understand. It's kind of like the Republicans winning over the Democrats in an election and saying, you know, they're not even a political party because they lost. If there are two parties, they are both politicians. If there are two games, they are both athletic teams. If there are two views and only two views, and scientists hold them and scientists disagree and the original scientist held one, I don't see how we can pronounce one unscientific. In fact, it's rather amusing. Why is it that the evolutionists are spending so much time, they're creating journals and organizations for the purpose of refuting scientific creationism? If it's not science, why do you have to argue against it scientifically? The very fact that they're attempting to oppose means that there is an opposing view. And if there is an opposing view, then when in the history of America have we reached the point where we will not allow opposing points of view to be taught in our science classrooms? The next point I would like to make under this question of is creationism science is to handle the question head on as to whether or not creationism is falsifiable because evolutionists say evolution is a falsifiable view. It can't be disproven scientifically. But creation isn't falsifiable. They admit it's a matter of faith, and therefore creationism is not science, but evolution is. Another aspect of this is that we are told by evolutionists that the evolutionary theory is tentative, whereas creationism is not a tentative view. So is it true that one is tentative and falsifiable and the other is not? In order to approach this point, I would like to give you a number of quotations from various scientists that illustrate the point that I'm about to make. One of the greatest philosophers of science in the world today is Karl Popper. He's recognized inside and outside the circles as one of the main scientists in the field, if not the greatest. In his book, Unended Quest, page 151, Karl Popper said this, quote, "Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program," end quote. That from one of the greatest living philosophers of science. Now, that has embarrassed the evolutionists. They have put extreme pressure on Karl Popper to change his views. In fact, not too long ago, he gave a modification that was published in a science journal in which he said, in some sense, you can test paleontology and historical geology. But he never gave up the position that Darwinism as a total theory and explanation is an unfalsifiable theory. It's just a metaphysical research program. I'm reading from a quote now that comes from D.B. Kitts in a journal called Evolution, International Journal of Organic Evolution, September 1974. Here's what he says. Thus, the paleontologist can provide knowledge that cannot be provided by biological principles alone. But he cannot provide us with evolution. The paleontologist, the one who studies the fossil record, cannot provide us with evolution. We can leave the fossil record free of a theory of evolution. An evolutionist, however, cannot leave the fossil record free of the evolutionary hypothesis. Well, now, if the theory of evolution is not evident in the fossil record, why is it that an evolutionist cannot leave the fossil record free from the evolutionary hypothesis? There's only one reason, because his view is not falsifiable, because he will not give it up, even when all the evidence goes against him. When after 120 years of looking for missing links, and we have not found a single missing link, of an animal in transition. Why is it that evolutionists don't give up the theory? Why do they go to punctuated equilibria like Gould? Because they aren't willing to give up evolution even though the facts are against it. Here's a quotation from the American Naturalist, January, February, 1976. He's speaking of the Darwinian theory and says, "The essence of the argument," referring to this article, "is that these theories are actually tautologies." Now, tautology is an empty statement that has no content to it. "The essence of the argument is that these theories, like Darwinian theories, are actually tautologies and as such cannot make empirically testable predictions. They are not scientific theories at all." Now, that's an article by a non-creationist in a secular journal entitled Tautology in Evolution and Ecology. All of these quotes come from evolutionists or non-creationists. Another one, H.P. Yaki wrote an article in the Journal of Theoretical Biology, 1977. Here's what he says. "One must conclude that contrary to the established and current wisdom, a scenario describing the genesis of life on Earth by chance and natural causes, which can be accepted on the basis of fact and not faith, has not yet been written." There's only one way, he said, that you can write a scenario on spontaneous generation of life, by faith. No such scenario has ever been written on a factual, scientific basis. Another quotation, David Baum in Toward a Theoretical Biology, 1968, says, "It seems clear that everybody has got some kind of metaphysics, even if he thinks he hasn't got any. Indeed, the practical, hard-headed individual who only goes by what he sees generally has a very dangerous kind of metaphysics. That is, the kind of which he is unaware. Dangerous because in it, assumptions and inferences are being mistaken for directly observed facts, with the result that they are effectively riveted in an almost unchangeable way into the structure of thought." Now that's worth pondering. That's worth exegeting word for word. He said the people that are most dangerous in our society are people who have a metaphysics so riveted to their scientific observations that they don't know it's there. That they're looking at it through colored glasses, say red-colored glasses, and it looks red to them because they never stop to analyze the glasses through which they're looking at the material. He said everybody has these, and the most dangerous type of person is the hard-headed individual who says, "I go just by the facts." Then he continues to say this is dangerous because his assumptions and inferences are being mistaken for directly observed facts. That's why an evolutionist can look at the fossil record with no transitional fossils and see evolution bouncing up the stairway out of these great leaps. He continues
in the same article to say this. One of the best ways of a person becoming aware of his tacit metaphysical assumptions is to be confronted by several other kinds. The first reaction is one of violent disturbance. Nevertheless, if he will stay with it, rather than escape into anger or unjustified reaction of contrary ideas, he becomes aware of the assumptive character of a great many previously unquestioned features of his own thinking. Now, that's good advice to the present evolutionist. Hang in there. There's another way of looking at things. A creationist way. It has a different set of presuppositions. It's a supernatural framework, not a naturalistic philosophy. But it'll help you to realize the naturalistic presuppositions of your way of thinking. And when the two are put side by side, you'll actually learn something. Educationally, pedagogically, it's an excellent way of teaching. It's been proven that students who follow the two-model system actually learn more about evolution while they're studying creation, because they can see them point by point, contrast by contrast. It's a heuristic value. It's of great educational value, and it's great for revealing the metaphysical presuppositions that one has. J. W. N. Sullivan, in his book, The Limitations of Science, made this statement. It becomes an accepted doctrine that life never arises except from life. So far as actual evidence goes, this is still the only possible conclusion. But since it is a conclusion that seems to lead back to some supernatural creative act, it is a conclusion that scientific men find very difficult to accept. Now we're getting close to the problem. Do you know why they're reacting against creation? Is not because their view is falsifiable. They won't give it up under any condition. They just flip to new theories to explain it. They won't accept creationism because creationism implies a creator. And they find this very difficult to accept. Let me tell you why it's difficult to accept. Last year, I was having a debate at Dartmouth College and Mount Holyoke in the East. The next day, an atheist took me out for lunch. He was an nuclear physicist, from an Ivy League school with a Ph.D. I say that, and I may repeat it again, because when I tell you what he said, it will sound a little incredible. He said to me, "I believe that all that exists are molecules or matter. There is no soul, no spirits, no God." He was a pure materialist. So trying to get on his wavelength, I asked him, "Could you tell me what a scientific theory is?" I thought a scientific theory obviously isn't made of molecules. It's a theory about molecules, and it's not made of molecules, and he would surely see that point. His answer to me was, "A scientific theory is magic." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No. The origin of chemistry is alchemy. Science is just magic." So I tried another question. I said, "What's your basis for accepting this position?" He said, "Faith." I thought to myself, they laugh at us. Faith in magic was his basis for materialism. So I tried one more question. I said, "Why did you choose to believe that? Because faith is a choice rather than choosing to believe something else, say, for example, God." I wasn't prepared for the honesty of his answer. He said, "Because it is ethically more comfortable for me to believe this way." I think the final punchline in this debate of creation versus science is creation does imply a creator. And that makes people ethically uncomfortable who aren't willing to face the realities that the scientific facts themselves lead to. There are grave scientific implications in this issue, but evolution is no more falsifiable than creation. Evolution is no less a faith than creationism is, and the question is, are you going to place your faith in magic as a basis of materialism, my friend, your faith in blind chance, or are you going to place your faith in a purposeful God who created heaven and earth? Our Father, we thank you for the privilege to reflect and discuss, to understand the scientific and religious implications of the issue with which we are faced. Give us clarity of thought, clearness of conviction, as we engage in defense of the faith. In these days we pray through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.